Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees. So our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we, out of an abundance of caution, reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We are working to help keep you informed, and we appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you are welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. Our topic for today is the role of the African diaspora in fighting the coronavirus pandemic in Africa. And our two distinguished guests via Skype are Paminda Veer, OBE, a former Chief Executive Officer of the Tony Erumero Foundation. She joins us from London in the United Kingdom. And Kwabena Boateng, President of the Africa Diaspora Nation and Chairman of the Historically Black Colleges and Universities Homecoming Initiative. He joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Well, I have to say, Paminda and Boateng, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Shaka. It's always a pleasure being here.
You're most welcome. Unfortunately, these are very difficult circumstances, as you can see.
Indeed.
We are not originating from the luxury of our studios. We are having to come to you direct from home in lockdown. Well, let me first of all come to you, Paminda. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's lovely to be speaking with you, and thank you so much for making the time.
It's really a pleasure to be able to talk to you for the first time. Given our brief chat, I couldn't believe that you knew one of my co-chairs of my doctorate dissertation at UCLA, the short name Gabriel.
He was an extraordinary man, an extraordinary figure, who really influenced my, I guess, a deeper theoretical understanding of what was then called, as you know, the Third World Cinema. And he inspired me to organize a film festival called Third Eye, London's Festival of Third World Cinema, which he actually attended as well.
He was a great guy, there's no question about it. And his soul rest in eternal peace, really.
His contribution is, you know, obviously it lives on, right, in filmmakers that he inspired in that time, and certainly me. But I think his fundamental contribution for me was about how do we change the African narrative.
That is correct. And of course, he was helped by none other than the Senegalese hero, the man that was known as the father of the African cinema.
Absolutely.
Senbene Ousmane.
Yes.
Well,
but also other filmmakers like Haile Gerima.
Yes, indeed. He teaches here at nearby Howard University, as a matter of fact. Now, talk to me. It's a long time since you last headed the Tony Erumero Foundation in Nigeria. What are you doing these days in London?
I stepped down as the CEO of the Tony Erumero Foundation in April 2019 after spending 5 years there. I went to Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria, at his invitation because he has this extraordinary vision to empower African entrepreneurs. And he had committed $100 million of his own family wealth to supporting African startups. And the universe conspired for us to meet. And he threw me a challenge and he said, would I come to Africa? Would I come to Lagos to help him really operationalize that vision? And I spent 5 extraordinary years living in Lagos, Nigeria, which I miss now very much, traveling across the 54 African countries, meeting firsthand African SMEs and African entrepreneurs. So when the coronavirus hit, obviously the West, from China, from Asia, coming to the West, it was not going to be that long before it went to Africa. And on the 1st of April, I had this wake-up call, like, my gosh, we have to do something to really support the African SMEs, which, as Mr. Alumulu used to say and continues to say, is the lifeblood of the African economy. And that's what I have been doing over the last 4 weeks, sitting in the comfort zone of my home in London now. I'm really helping, working with a number of African SMEs based in Nigeria, in Sierra Leone, in Kenya, in South Africa, in Cote d'Ivoire, well, anywhere, because, you know, when I was the CEO of the foundation, we supported entrepreneurs in 54 of those of the African countries. Working with them to looking at what their challenges are and what are some of the solutions that we can collectively share to literally, you know, hold them through this coronavirus period.
And what would you say has been the response so far?
The response has been phenomenal. I mean, it's not like that the African SMEs, they've never been waiting with a handout to be helped, yeah? They are extraordinarily resilient. And, you know, it was a question for me, it was always a question of gathering and curating information and resources, which we know are available. And we, you know, and particularly those that are relevant to the African continent, and making them available on one, in a one-stop shop. So we created a website, www.supportforafricasmes.com, where we're literally gathering the resources and putting them for people to be able to come and literally use them in any ways that they can. I think so the first part has been sharing resources, and Kwabena, when he heard about this campaign, joined us in that campaign, and he'll talk more about that. I think the second one has been to constantly tell their story, you know, stories of hope, stories of resilience, stories of finding solutions in this incredibly challenging times.
Very interesting. Kwabena, I know that you and I have met so many times via the platform of Straight Talk Africa. Now, talk to me about the Africa Diaspora Nation. What exactly is the Africa Diaspora Nation? And should we, by the way, begin to refer to you as His Excellency, the President?
That was an interesting curveball, Shaka. But it is always a pleasure to be in your company and hearing you go back and forth with Parminder about your shared history in terms of one influential person in your life. Run some thoughts through my mind. I felt like asking you all why the stories of Agri, the stories of Kwame Nkrumah have not been told in film, right? And maybe there's a grand conspiracy for this reunion. Maybe we can do your mentors proud. Anyway, that's a conversation we will carry on later. But when it comes to African Diaspora Nation, as you very well know, Shaka, a lot has been told and said about the enormous potential of the African diaspora for development, to drive sustainable development. If you look at remittances from the African diaspora into Africa, it actually exceeds foreign direct investment. Mm-hmm. The only issue is that it's been more of a subsistence framework, right? Remittance framework to address issues of a family member here and there, but not really consolidated within, concentrated to drive development, right? So what was missing was the need for a coalition platform, which essentially brings the African diaspora together And that is what African Diaspora Nation is. It's the vision of African Diaspora Nation is to be the embodiment of a bridge and a guiding light for a global African renaissance that truly liberates the human spirit, the African spirit. And that translates into economic empowerment, right? Sustainable development goals, you're looking at empowering people, education, innovation, infrastructure. And that is exactly what this platform means to do. We are really committed to those goals being accomplished because those goals really empower people. And that's essentially why African Diaspora Nation was formed. What you've heard so much about before has been our education initiative, which is the HBCU Africa Homecoming Initiative. And in this pandemic, we find a unique opportunity not to shrink, but to actually step up and out boldly to declare a unique opportunity for us to come together. Essentially, we shouldn't waste the opportunity, that social capital that comes with this period.
I know, for example, that when it comes to the African diaspora that deals with the historically Black colleges and universities homecoming experience, you collaborate with forces on the continent. Specifically, I know that you are actively collaborating with the Republic of Ghana, where you come from. What about in this particular case, who are you specifically collaborating with on the continent?
All right, so we see it as a number of steps. First step is mobilizing the African diaspora, right? So that we come together as one unified force within one global context, right, of impact. The second step, which is some of the conversations I've also been having with Parminda, is who are the stakeholders on the ground, particularly based on her experience on the ground, who we can work with. And she has some suggestions on that. So that is still fluid. But it's important that we start these conversations on actually mobilizing and coming together, and then we move on to that next stage.
Parminda, in your efforts to work together or collaborate with Kwabena, I know that you obviously have been complementing and supplementing one another. What specific areas are we talking about here? Walk us through some of those areas, please.
I think the amazing thing over, you know, certainly over the last 5 years, in 2015, you know, we said, and Mr. Olumide in fact declared that the next decade will be the decade of the African entrepreneur. And the government, the development agencies, the entrepreneurship ecosystem, the incubators, the accelerators, everyone was beginning to embrace entrepreneurship, yeah? And what was also brilliant was the diaspora, which whose remittance had been so vital for the economic growth of certain sections of the African societies, was also beginning to look at how they could use their remittance now also as investment, because they could see some investment, viable investment opportunities in enterprises which were based in Africa, and were there to serve Africa across all the sectors, yeah? Particularly in countries like Ethiopia, like Nigeria, and like Ghana as well. Many of the countries were beginning to look to how they could diversify their economies. We know how important it is that countries don't become dependent on one sector, oil, the curse of the oil, as we all know, in terms of Nigeria. So it was beginning to emerge, and a lot of the work that Kawab Parna and his organization was already doing in terms of with the African diaspora, it wasn't just educating them about Africa. It was also about bringing to their attention the opportunities in Africa, in agriculture, in ICT, in the healthcare, in education, across all the sectors, across the continent. and the importance of building an African entrepreneurial class. So I would like to see that those collaborations will continue. But I also recognize that in this time of coronavirus, that the African diaspora itself is under pressure. Yeah, I certainly know it from, you know, living in the UK, that a lot of the African, a lot of us immigrants or the immigrant generation are daily wage earners. Yeah, a lot of, in the lockdown, a lot of that money flow will be affected. I suppose my call to the African diaspora is, you know, as the African Development President said, you know, social distancing doesn't mean fiscal distancing. That we begin to look at new ways and different ways and innovative ways of continuing that link with Africa, the African continent, and share maybe social capital, maybe intellectual capital, share resources, become mentors to some of the businesses that are struggling to really stay alive in the continent, yeah? Begin to talk to the governments of the African countries about some of the kinds of fiscal stimulus packages, certainly that we are beginning to benefit from sitting in the UK, Europe, and the US. How can we adapt some of those and bring them to the African continent so that we don't allow the African SME sector to die in this period of the coronavirus?
Paminda, if you may excuse me, I know from talking to you that you happen to be a British of Indian descent. You were born in India. What triggered or what inspired you to focus on things African as Eliza Beam?
Well, as we began earlier on in the conversation about the impact of African intellectuals like Tshomi Gabriel, African creatives like Usman Sembin and others. Living in the UK, the privilege is that you live in a multicultural society. And I guess I am one of those, a product of that multicultural society, yeah? So my friends have been, you know, of artists, of filmmakers, of African, of Indian descent. I'm also married to someone who is from the Caribbean, whose ancestors, you know, came from Africa. But I think what really inspired me was, and I've made films across the continent in Angola, in Nigeria, in Algeria, et cetera, in my previous life as a filmmaker. But I think what really what was the turning point for me was to go and live there and do what I did working with the foundation. The opportunity was huge. And to see the transformation of young African entrepreneurs who, armed with some skills, tools for setting up a business skills tools, and with mentoring, we had about 3,000 plus mentors from around the world, a tiny bit of seed capital in the hands of these extraordinarily smart, aspirational young people and middle-aged and the older entrepreneurs as well, what they could do to transform their continent. And in those 5 years, I came back totally transformed. I had always believed that there was the African narrative that we were seeing in the West was not the right narrative, was not the, you know, the actual narrative. The narrative of the African continent is one of hope, one of aspiration. And the entrepreneurs and its entrepreneurs, for me, reflect that. And I think, you know, in the last 5 years, you know, you're constantly pursuing your passion and purpose. And I felt that all the work that I had done in the UK, in the arts, in film, the storytelling, all that sort of came together in 5 years of living and working in Africa. And I know that I will continue to do this work till the day I die. Because Africa matters. If Africa fails, we all fail. If Africa does not come through, if we allow Africa to succumb to the coronavirus, we will all, whether we're sitting in the UK or US, Europe, we will also all succumb to the coronavirus.
Pabena, how did you discover Pamina?
So the power of LinkedIn and also a unique personality trait she has, which is one of open-mindedness and a receptivity to people just reaching out, right? So the power of LinkedIn, and we found convergence in this transcendent course to work in advancing Africa and its entrepreneurial class, right? So that is where we came together. That is where the resonance happened. And once I encountered her, a thought came to mind, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Shaka. When Kwame Nkrumah said, "You're not African because you were born in Africa. You are African because Africa has been born in you." She is a testimony, a living testimony to that. And it has been quite an honor engaging her, Shaka.
You know, she sort of reminds me of the great Mahatma Gandhi, of course. A man, of course, who in many, many ways was probably in a position to inspire the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
That's right.
Now, Pabena, what about you? Really, I know that you come from a very rich and wealthy culture of legendaries, such as the Osagyefo himself, the man from Crawford, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. What inspired you to focus on Africa like a laser beam? Because whatever you do, at least whatever I have known about you being involved in, is Africa, not Ghana, not your local community, but Africa.
I find purpose, right, in engaging Africa because I know of its enormous potential. I know of its true narrative as against what has historically been shared. And also, I'll say my upbringing, right? I had the opportunity to walk in the same halls as some of the greats, and just being nurtured within the context that as an Achimotan in Ghana, it wasn't just about Ghana, it was about leadership of Africa. And to have people like James Agri, who was known as the father of African education, to have people like the Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, all going through that institution, there is a lot of inspiration in knowing their stories. And finally, my journey coming to the United States kind of amplified and further clarified what Africa means to me, attending historically Black colleges and universities. And secondly, my work with Chevron Corporation, which gave me the opportunity to not only work in the United States, New Orleans, Houston, Angola, Nigeria, stint in South Africa, right? So all those things come together, and I found a great love for Africa. For me, I breathe Africa, and I live Africa. And one last thing, the Ghanaian national anthem has a line, I think it's the third stanza. It says, with Africa advance, right? It's not just about Ghana alone, but it's about advancing with Africa as a whole. And of course, lastly, the statement by a man I continue to admire, Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, at our independence, that the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it is linked to the total liberation of the entire African continent. Right. So those things speak to me in a significant way. It speaks to this same theme about injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. And that is what has shaped my perspective.
And as a matter of fact, Kobena, I think it would make sense to inform our audience that this Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, did not simply speak those beautiful words, did not simply challenge Ghanaians that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it is linked with the total liberation of Africa. He actually went beyond talking the talk. That's and actually right. Walked the talk so that Africa could, in fact, walk the walk with the independence of South Africa in 1994.
So let me just pick that up theme up about walking the talk and also about seeing yourself from one country, one of the 54 countries, but seeing yourself as part of the continent. And that's what really attracted me to Mr. Tony Elumelu, when he could easily have said, come and help me operationalize my vision to support and empower African entrepreneurs for Nigeria, yeah? But he said, no, I want to do this, Parminder, as a pan-African program, and I want to commit for 10 years in terms of the supporting and the development of those. And that, and what, and you know, in that one statement and his action, and what amazed me was that how we did unite the African continent and the 54 African countries through entrepreneurship, and how in the first year we had 20,000 applications, and by the time I stepped down, we had 250,000 applications from 54 African countries, the Francophone, the Lusophone, and the Anglophone countries. So there was clearly an extraordinary underlying rhythm and underlying energy that connected the African continent. And, you know, and young people, I mean, you know, in our first, I remember bringing all 1,000 of those entrepreneurs from those 54 African countries. And there was a Malian entrepreneur hugging a Nigerian, a Ghanaian, an Algerian, a Tunisian, you know, an Egyptian. And this one entrepreneur from Egypt said, you know, thank you very much. You've connected me to my brothers and sisters in Africa. Until then, Egypt and Northern Africa had seen themselves more as part of the Mediterranean and Europe. So I think we should not underestimate, and this is my call, and we were talking about this whole role of advocacy. This is our call to the government leaders, who we have to say, thank you very much, because they are certainly stepping up to the mark, whether it's the Ghanaian president, Macky Sall from Senegal, from Uganda, from Kenya, from Nigeria. Look at the, you know, the unprecedented stimulus package that the president of South Africa has announced for his country, the extraordinary op-ed that the prime minister of Ethiopia led the call for African leaders, the African government leaders and political leaders to come together, but also followed very quickly by the African Union and followed even more quickly by the Africa Development Bank, the development agencies, both African as well as international, all saying we have to come together to work to support Africa through this time. And all of them, to my delight, have made sure that they put and, you know, supporting African SMEs through this time a high priority, because they know that the African SMEs are the lifeblood of the continent. Without them, yes, we may be able to come through the coronavirus, but we have to then begin to pick up and build the economies of those countries. Yeah? Who's going to do that? It is the SMEs. We cannot afford right now to allow the African SMEs to die.
Whereas I often say, time is not our best ally. And for that matter, we'll go for a break and continue with the discussion when we come back. Please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. Every week, connect with our experts. You can ask them your questions and get their advice. Join me, Lino Hormoudou, in Washington on Healthy Living, your new health program, right here on Voice of America.
Welcome back to this special edition of Straight Talk Africa. It is very interesting, Faminda, that you talked about how Tony Elumelu was not only looking at Nigeria, but he was in fact looking at Francophone Africa, was looking at Anglophone Africa, was looking at Lusophonic Africa. What about the Bantuphone or Africaphone? How come I do not hear those concepts that clearly reflect the heart of Africa?
I mean, I used to say that, you know, for me, the African continent is not Lusophone, Anglophone, or Francophone. That's the colonial heritage. But the important thing was that, yes, you know, Africa was left with 54 African countries, yeah? So our program, you know, this particular initiative was to connect those, you know, the African entrepreneurs and African startups or Africans with the dream to have a business, dream to be their own boss, yeah? You know, that they had, it was about democratizing opportunity and institutionalizing life, right? That we gave them that, we created the opportunity in which into which they could participate.
Very interesting. Fabena, it's very interesting that your fellow panelist talks about the 54 African countries. As a matter of fact, if you were to add Western Sahara, which is recognized by the African Union, but not the international community, we would be talking about 55 superficial countries, which basically got their reputation in 1884, the Berlin Conference. We're talking about Prince Bismarck here.
Yes.
What about the virus, which clearly has demonstrated that it has absolutely no respect for those type of boundaries, those types of borders. It has absolutely no respect for social economic differences. It has absolutely no respect for your race, your gender, your ideology. What should we learn from this?
I think the unique opportunity that we have is to realize that we are all tied to one common fabric, right? One human fabric. And at the end of the day, it's about rising up and transcending these superficial elements which appear to differentiate us, whether it's class, whether it's color, right? That in this time is becoming very evident that you cannot live as an island, right? And that is the social capital that we can accrue from this experience. And I hope it doesn't leave us and we are able to leverage that same social capital to work more collaboratively to build not only businesses, but spaces and relationships which ultimately result in the liberation of the African spirit, the liberation of the human spirit, right? One thing I learned from Achimota School, which I'll mention quickly, is the concept of the piano keys, right? And you can play a tune of sorts. Absolutely, right? And that is what has been drilled into me, right? You can play a tune of sorts with the white keys, you can play a tune of sorts with the black keys, but to really make harmony, you need to play across all these keys, right? So really, education is something which is crucial so far as orienting us into this consciousness and developing leaders who actually architect a global economic order which reflects this understanding that I cannot be whole, right, until everyone is whole, that humanity cannot be whole till Africa is whole. I mean, that kind of thinking, I believe, is something which we have a unique opportunity to usher in, particularly in this COVID-19 era, because there's definitely a need for a new global economic order. The Ghanaian Minister of Finance, Ken Oforiatta, wrote an article in the Financial Times, and he landed on exactly this point. I mean, you look at the tools available to the U.S., right? How they're able to quickly come up with billions and trillions. We don't have those same tools on the African side. We come into the IMF, we come into the World Bank, and this presents a unique opportunity to actually architect an order which is truly liberating for all.
I just to follow up on that, I really think, you know, this is a unique opportunity for the African continent. For too long, it's been a continent that's been extracted. People from my own country, from my country of birth, India, have gone to Africa for work, for business, yeah? And they've extracted. I think there's an opportunity post-coronavirus to think about, to think of Africans, developing Africa for Africans, yeah? So that's one. I think the second is that the African continent needs to embrace and harness its human capital. For me, that's just much more valuable than what lies under the ground. And also it's, this wild, it's extraordinary, natural environment. The human capital is one of Africa's biggest capital. And the African government leaders, everybody now needs to begin to invest in that human capital. I think the other thing that it's shown is that, African governments, you have a phenomenal role to play. Now play it with a sense of responsibility and a sense of legacy that you're going to leave behind. There's no need. Why is it that Africans spend millions of dollars education in the UK and the US in terms of, going abroad for education, for health tourism? Well, I remember one of the entrepreneurs I met in Ghana, she was producing hospital, her business was literally that she was going to make, the protective clothing that you wear in hospitals. This was about 2 years ago. I mean, and she was having struggle trying to get the hospitals to let her company produce those clothes. Now we know in coronavirus, the masks that we needed, the PPE that we needed, became so hard to come by because it was only produced in one continent, yeah? And finally, I think it's really going to be a time where African governments across the 54 countries begin to look at how do you keep the value chains across the sectors in the countries, because it is only in the value chain that you create jobs, yeah? The moment you take raw material and you send it outside and then have it shipped back to you, polished, cashew nuts or, oil, yeah? You are playing, you're not only paying a huge price, but you're also not developing the skill base that you need across the continent. So I think the coronavirus, ironically, offers also a huge opportunity for the African continent. Obviously for the African SMEs to be ready to take advantage of that. But I think also for the governments and the international development partners to rethink their relationship with the African continent.
Now, talking about that type of relationship, I am sure that you have heard of alarming reports from China, from the People's Republic of China, how the Chinese are treating Africans resident in China. Could you believe that the Chinese are basically mistreating the Africans in China, while the Chinese have actually gotten the status of being the second most important economy in the world on the backs of Africans. Because for China to be the factory of the world, China has to depend on oil coming from Africa. We are talking about Angola, Nigeria. We are talking about Gabon. We are talking about Equatorial Guinea, and you name it. We are talking about copper and cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo. We are talking about coltan from Congo. We are talking about copper and cobalt from Zambia, and you name it. And yet, when it comes to interacting with Africans, they see nothing of value. What does this virus teach us in the context of those types of relationships to be able to find a way of restoring what used to be called by the African founding fathers, the African personality, the African dignity?
Wow. For me, it is just getting another level of resolve, right? To be self-determined, to develop the capacity to be self-sufficient on the continent, because at the end of the day, nobody can do it for you like you can do for yourself, right? So we have to take these as lessons and really envision and architect a program of action that not only looks at the entrepreneurial ecosystem, but also looks at the human capital development in terms of education, as well as the harmonization of regimes, which allow us to look at the continent as a single market, like we've seen with the Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, right? The time has come for us to really rise up and architect the future we really want, to own it, so that we don't necessarily have to have our people going into places where they are not welcome. And secondly, just recognizing the fact that not being too certain from my end whether it is a state policy, this harassment, right? Or it is individuals who are acting out of ignorance, right? I wonder that, right? But we ideally want to have a situation where people are nurtured wherever they are to respect the basic human dignity of all people. But for me, it's an opportunity to leverage this occurrence and say, hey, let's build our continent. Let's make it a promised land, which really helps to liberate us in terms of economics, as well as affirming our own dignity as a people.
About some who suggest that this particular virus has probably helped us to look back in our history, to look back in African culture, where you talk about African culture, you are talking about extended relationships. Mm-hmm. You are talking about not the individual, but the community. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, a former American First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, wrote a book whose title was It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. And interestingly, it is that same village that sustains a community. Any particular reasons why Africans do not now look at each other as each other's keeper, as your neighbor's keeper, your brother's keeper, your sister's keeper, your grandma's keeper, your grandpa's keeper?
I think it's got to do with identity. Right? People think that the identity issue within the Pan-African ecosystem is just within the diaspora. But I think that, you know, there has been a situation where we have define education, right, within the context of how other we became from our true and authentic selves. The paradigm of education that for a long time we had came out of the legacy of colonialism, right? So we need to articulate this future we want and recognize that we need to define education within our own context, within our own shared value system of Ubuntu, right? And we need to architect our societies within that context without forgetting that we still need to have a meritocratic element, right? So for me, it's an issue of forgetting our values, and it will take education on many fronts, from a family perspective, from a national formal educational framework, and ultimately how we even architect the way we do business to address that, if you ask me.
Aminda, there are some who have compared this virus assault on humanity as a sort of third world war. But a third world war without the air forces, the mighty air forces, tanks, and satellites and what have you. But that this, in fact, happens to be a war where nations do not choose sides. All nations seem to be or happen to be on one side vis-a-vis the virus. How do you react to that?
I mean, yes, they are on the one side, but you also see, before the virus, I was reading this, I was trying to understand the emergence of nationalism, and particularly in the, and you know, and the kind of the right wing, and particularly in the context of, you know, Brexit and, you know, what's happening, what was happening in America, like, where did this nationalism come from, you know? How did it begin? When did the seeds of it begin to be planted and began to grow? And to my amazement, I woke up and we were all being very nationalistic. You know, it was, Britain was taking care of the British, the Italians were taking care of the Italians, the Germans, the Nigerians, the Zambians, etc. You know, so we all, the virus also made us go inwards and say, I need to take care of my immediate family, community, country, etc. So I guess, you know, the lockdown is a has been a pause button where I hope that we will emerge from this with, you know, as deeper human beings. Hope that this time of lockdown is also a time of reflection, because there isn't much else you can do. You know, you can only watch so much television. You can, you know, if you're not, and you can read so much, but it is a time of reflection. And I'd like to think that, and yes, there are amazing moments of, you know, human solidarity. You know, I mean, I still cry when I go outside and you clap for the heroes. Yeah, at the here, we're clapping for them, you know, the National Health Service workers. But, you know, I would also clap for the heroes in across the African continent called the farmers, who are still trying, you know, who are going out there. A number of the entrepreneurs that I worked with are farmers. And they, you know, one farmer, you know, Joel Cherip, in fact, from Uganda, said to me, I managed to sneak out in the mornings to my farm, and I still continue to plant, and I still continue to harvest, yeah? So for me, they're also people that I want to be clapping for, yeah? I think we know over time immemorial we've had, you know, civilization has gone up and down, and this is a moment in modern history. I never thought that I would live through in my lifetime a pandemic. I've never lived through a Second World or a First World War, but it really is a wake-up call. It's not going to be business as usual. There is no such thing as going back to normal life, right? But it is about mindset shifts. And I think for me, the fundamental mindset shift that needs to take place in terms of the African continent is that Africa needs to begin to develop Africa for Africans, and particularly its young generation, the future generation of Africans.
Talking about the heroes, we are talking, of course, about those heroes who are in the front line of fighting the coronavirus. We are talking about doctors with real clinics, not like me, who happens to be a doctor of philosophy. We're talking about nurses. And when it comes to doctors and nurses from Africa, you can see many of them in the front lines of Europe, in the front lines of North America. Shouldn't this really provide us a huge window of opportunity to bring about the badly needed United Nations Security Council reforms, given that the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, the five members, are beneficiaries of having won or having found themselves on the side that supposedly won the Second World War. And in this particular case, we are all fighting a virus, which happens, frankly, to be an equal opportunity employer. Shouldn't this be reflected in the composition of the United Nations Security Council?
Absolutely, Shaka. And you know, I haven't heard anybody say it better and articulate it that way, right? But it is very clear that that reform is urgent. And as a matter of fact, as I heard you speak, I'm inspired to leave this conversation and go start a petition on change.org that this needs to happen. And I think the conversations have started happening on the economic front, IMF, World Bank. It needs to be extended to the UN reform, and it will take people making their voices heard. These frontline workers working in the health sector who are firefighting this virus, all these voices coming together across the continent and across the world saying, hey, this time, as we shape what the future will look like, we need to make sure that every voice is counted. Because the truth of the matter is, the architecture of the global economic order, it wasn't built with the voices of Africans in the room, neither the voices of African diasporans, neither the voices of Indians, right? So the rest of us have learned to live within the system which has been created for us. But now we have a unique opportunity to make our voices heard in architecting a new order, which is more just from a social and economic perspective, and which also respects the need for environmental sustainability.
The issues of lockdown, you know as well as I do that when it comes to North America and the Western world, for example, when you talk about social distancing, lockdown, it is accompanied with economic lifeline. What about in Africa, where some of these leaders have basically sent their people to go inside their house without any accompanying economic lifeline or economic stimulus? Aren't they likely to actually find that their people in lockdown are probably fighting another equally potent virus, which is starvation?
Yeah. No, a lot of, you know, I mean, these are all stories that we're hearing, you know, from business owners. I mean, these are people who had, you know, properly organized businesses. They were registered, they're taxpayers. They are no longer able to generate income, yeah? Because there isn't the customer to go out and sell that to. Then there are obviously all the, you know, highly densely populated areas, right, which are the shebeens, the shanty towns, you can call them whatever you want, where this notion of social distancing is, I mean, it just doesn't. You know, and there are people saying, you know, I'm more likely to die of starvation than I am of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is an underbelly across the African continent, which really needs to be, it's an explosive situation that you can see that the government, the political leaders, the international development and the donor agencies are trying to get their heads around in terms of how to respond. There's a lot of an unrest across the continent. A lot of it is being contained, but how long will it be contained? And just really hard measures are being deployed by the army, the police, etc. But amongst them, there are some amazing examples also. I then hear of stories where the communities in their local areas have organized to make food available, to have bike riders who can deliver food to people who cannot travel out. But the people who have been really, really severely hit and the government needs to provide a lifeline to them are the daily wage earners. And we know that 70-80% of the people who work in those countries are a daily wage earner.
What about the issue, and in fact, the important issue of healthcare facilities in Africa?
And we've already started seeing signs of that. You know, so I've been following closely what is happening in Ghana, for example, right? Just about 3 days ago, the president announced that we're building 88 new healthcare facilities addressing regions or districts which don't have any medical facility at all. And I think, again, that is one of the examples of the unique openings that we have with this coronavirus.
The thing now is to really invest money. We know that the health sector, the health infrastructure across the African continent is weak. We know it never really existed. It existed. The elite were able to leave and the poor had to make do with whatever was available. If you look at India, it didn't have a health infrastructure 20, 25 years ago. Look at it now. Majority of the Africans are now going to India for health tourism. Now is the opportunity, obviously face masks and PPEs and all of those are really mission critical things that we need to do now. But really what African and the African, all the countries across the continent need to begin to do is to build a long lasting health infrastructure that's there for all of us people and not just a few of us people.
On that note, our distinguished guests were Paminda Vir, OBE, or Order of the British Empire, if I remember my history correctly, and Kwabena Boate, Get Better, Not Bitter Africa, and please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.